Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Tuesday Topics, an opportunity for people who are blind or visually impaired or interested in those subjects to get together once each week to talk about topics, everything from technology to travel and anything in between. This evening, I'm going to be acting as the show's host because we have as our guest this evening the show's standard host. My name is Brian Charlson. I'm in Boston, Massachusetts. I'd like to start by thanking those who are recording for us this evening and, again, those who are going to convert this rather chaotic experience into something of broadcast quality, we hope. I'd also like to thank George Bias and Talking Communities for providing us with this service that allows us to use an audio chat room to create the show each week. Let me remind everybody of the format of our show. For the first 30 minutes or so, I'll be conducting an interview with our guest, and then we'll open the mic for questions from the audience. We'd ask that when you ask your first question, you identify yourself, and that you restrict yourself to a single question until everybody else has had an opportunity to ask one. The topic of the evening is Mr. Paul Edwards of Miami, Florida, who has many, many hats on his particular tree, including immediate past president of the American Council of the Blind, Disabled Student Services Coordinator for the, I believe it's the North Campus of Miami-Dade College. I believe they've changed their name once again. He also serves on the board of directors of our accrediting organization. I'll give him a chance to speak to that in a moment. And this is our opportunity to get to know our host. Paul does act as the host for at least four-fifths of the programs here on Tuesday Topics. And he has found himself perfectly capable of asking questions on virtually any topic. So it's our turn to turn the tables. So I'm going to start off, Paul, by asking you to please give a brief childhood, if you will, autobiography. I'll give it to you and let you bring it up to where we'll start the interview.
I must admit to finding it a little bit strange not to be in a place where I can ask questions. It might have been fun to interview myself, but this actually would be more fun. I was born in San Francisco, California, and lived in California for the first 7 years of my life. I attended kindergarten in a regular school and then went to the California School for the Blind where, to my chagrin and horror, I was required to do kindergarten again. I felt like something was a failure as a result of that. At the age of 7, I moved to Canada, where I lived in Calgary, Alberta, and went to school in Vancouver, British Columbia. And at the age of 13, I moved to Jamaica, where I did high school at a school called the Priory School, and actually ended up dropping out of school for a couple of years for some rather strange reasons, and ended up going back to Priory to take A-levels, which were kind of the way that one got into university, and then took scholarship exams for the University College of the West Indies, which was then a part of the University of London, and was fortunate enough to win an open scholarship, and did my bachelor's degree as a special honors degree in history, and then went on to a branch of the Institute of International Relations of Geneva, Switzerland, that had opened in Trinidad, and ended up doing a master's degree in international relations, after which, having gotten married, I taught high school in Trinidad for 10 years and at the same time acquired a second master's degree, this one in education. So that is sort of my early life, sir.
You mentioned that you got married. I assume that there's a possibility, at least, of children. How many kids do you have, and how's your family laid out at this point?
Three children. Two girls and a boy, all now very much fully grown. Each of them now have grandchildren. I have six grandchildren at the moment, and another on the way, which will in September take me up to seven grandchildren. My boy was born in 1973, which makes him 33 years old already. So, as you can tell, I'm an awfully old man.
Those who've known you in your recent past with ACB, of course, know of Gail Krause, your wife, who passed away a little over a year ago. She was your second wife, correct?
That is correct. There have only been two of them so far. That may change. In fact, I hope it will. Gail was my second wife, and we were together from 1986 until her death in 2005.
So anything else on the private side here other than the occasional hobby thing that I'm going to bring in over the course of the balance of this interview that you'd like to put on the table so we can see the complete works of Paul Edwards?
I have a fiancée now who I'm very proud of, whose name is Cheryl Stewart from Wenatchee, Washington. That will put me in an interesting situation in that I will once more be raising at least a child because I hope, end up with a stepdaughter whose name is Hannah, who is 10. So that's sort of interesting, I think. I'm very fortunate to have someone like Cheryl have anything to do with me, so I feel very lucky.
Congratulations. So, at this point, you've been living in Florida for how long?
Since 1976. I started out here in Miami and then couldn't find a job, ended up going to the rehab center, ended up finding my own job where I worked for the Division of Blind Services for 6 years, first as a rehabilitation teacher, and I won't even dare to tell you what they call themselves now, and then as a rehabilitation counselor, primarily working with a college-level caseload. And then in 1983, I moved to Jacksonville, where I became the director of a private agency serving blind people called iLab, which doesn't sound quite as obnoxious as it did. It stands for Independent Living for the Adult Blind. And then moved to Miami in 1986 after my divorce and after meeting Gail. We decided that whatever city both of us could get jobs in, we would move to and start off fresh there. And so I became director of services to students with disabilities on the North Campus of Miami-Dade College in 1986 and just received a clock. I can't read. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Just received a lovely clock for 20 years of service at Miami-Dade College about 2 weeks ago.
Those kinds of things happen even at institutions that are exclusively blindness-oriented, believe me. So you've been there for a number of years, and can you describe for us what you do at the college?
Well, I'm director of services to students with disabilities on my campus, but as with most colleges these days, you don't only do your job, you do lots of others. So I do a fair amount of grant writing, serve on lots of committees. Miami-Dade College is the largest community college in the country, and altogether, we just graduated, and we started in 1964, we just graduated our millionth graduate here at Miami-Dade and serve in community education and vocational education and degree-seeking students right at a quarter of a million students a year. We have, I keep pausing because it's hard to remember them all. We have 9 campuses now, and that number may in fact continue to grow. On my campus, we serve about 25,000 students a semester, something around 600 disabled students a semester.
What's the demographic of the disabilities? What, do you have a predominance of one disability as opposed to the other?
Many years ago, we were a magnet for almost any disability because our program was a good deal further along than many others. They've played catch-up now. About half of our students are learning disabled. An increasing number are psychologically disabled. We serve right at 40 or so blind students a semester and about the same number of deaf students with a few more mobility-impaired folks.
Are there particular aspects of being a disabled student at Miami-Dade that would cause me to be proud of how the process works?
I think it depends an awful lot on what you consider to be valuable about serving students with disabilities. My view is that the job of a disabled student services office is to promote independence. And so we don't do nearly so much for our students as many other institutions do. Our belief is that it's the student's responsibility to figure out how they're going to get their books. We make scanners available all over the place. We provide courses in access technology which train students to be functional at using the technologies that they need. And we provide computers and other equipment in classroom. We provide note takers. We provide tape recorders. And by note takers, I mean computer devices rather than people. For the most part, the philosophy is that if we've done our job, they will need our services less the longer they're at Miami-Dade College. And by the time they leave, they will be far more capable of being self-sufficient students in environments where they're likely to get far less assistance and service than they'll get from us.
What's the size and makeup of the staff that you supervise?
Full-time, very small and getting smaller. One deaf services coordinator, two advisors, one of whom also runs our learning center, and the other is our vocational education specialist, who has traditionally been paid out of Carl Perkins grant dollars, and one department secretary. Part-timers, because of the size of our population, typically supervise somewhere in the region of 50 part-timers every 2 weeks who provide services like note-taking and interpreting, and don't, for the most part, provide reader services because my view is that reader services are better provided by the Division of Blind Services, where students have the opportunity to choose their own reader and where we don't get in the middle. So a fairly large staff overall, if you count the part-timers, really almost 60.
You mentioned that you offer a course in adaptive technology for your students with disabilities. Can you describe that course in greater detail? Are you the instructor?
I started off as the instructor. I'm actually not now. It's a 4-credit course, and I'm kind of proud of it because it's actually part of the state curriculum, which means it could actually be taught at any other community college in the state as well. It is part of the course offering. And essentially, we teach it as an introduction to microcomputers, but we teach JAWS and Window Eyes. We teach Magic and Zoom Text. We teach scanning, email, use of the internet, Windows, Microsoft Word, a little bit of Excel, though that's becoming less as some of the access technology things become more, and as programs like JAWS and Window Eyes become more complex and more capable. There's a lot more to teach. And even though I'm not the instructor any longer for the course, I do actually continue to teach the scanning section.
Is there any instruction in the use of note takers?
Actually, in that course, no. We do have some note takers available. We haven't found that, for the most part, blind students come into college with the capacity to really use note takers as well as they ought. We have Braille and Speaks and Type and Speaks, which we make available for loan to students on a semester-by-semester basis. We have a PacMate, we have a Braille Light, and we will provide training for students who want to use these, and we'll make them available to them. We really encourage those students to be pretty proactive with the Division of Blind Services, and I'm very proud to say that our division now recognizes that if a student has the ability to use a note taker in a college environment, that the Division of Blind Services will typically buy them. We're also using Plex Talkers with some of our students now.
Did I recall correctly that you also are using book ports?
Yes, and in fact, we used the book ports' little brothers is when we actually started. We really find them very useful. And one of the interesting things is that while this technology is traditionally regarded as related to folks with visual impairment, we've had really amazing success using the same kind of technology with students with severe learning disabilities, and in particular for some autistic students for whom speech-equipped computing has represented an immense step forward. They've gone from failing classes to essentially getting A's and B's.
From a professional side, have I missed any major steps in the process?
I don't think so. I guess the one thing that I would probably add is that I think we're really still at a crossroads, because most community colleges and most colleges and most universities, including mine, still has a long way to go to become fully and categorically open to students with disabilities. Web pages still aren't really all that good. Distance learning is still an iffy process. We do a really good job at delivering accessible content using distance learning. And most of the computerized systems that we use for instructional classes are pretty accessible, but the registration process for distance college, distance learning is still an issue. It's a constant struggle, and I think the struggle will continue. Access services coordinators must continue to be at the forefront of pushing states and colleges and the federal government to do more to assure that the playing field remains equal, because it's going to get worse before it gets better. We're already seeing many colleges and universities going to models where all of the texts are provided in Microsoft ebooks or in PDF ebooks. And there are some real questions about whether they're accessible. We need to continue to work to ensure that we don't leave students with disabilities behind as technology becomes a more and more important component of delivering educational content.
We've dealt with your private life, as so to speak. We pretty much dealt with that, Paul. And now your professional life. How about your life in terms of consumerism? Where did you first get started in being involved as a leader in the blindness community?
I began as sort of a leader by default in the Caribbean. Was really the first place where I became actively involved with working with blind people. And it was an interesting experience because I had an opportunity to interact with a lot of blind people, many of whom had very little access to employment, very little access to education. I was the aberration there. I was the first blind student to graduate from high school and certainly the first to attend university in the West Indies. And by the time that I left, what I was beginning to see was an awakening of blind people there. But in spite of very little education and in spite of very little opportunity, blind people in the Caribbean became immensely independent and were immensely capable of many things. So one of the things that I guess I came away from the Caribbean with was a huge respect for how much a blind person could accomplish on his own if he chose to do that. When I came back to the States, I kind of had some pretty rude shocks.
Do you think that being Caucasian assisted you? Or was that a difficult aspect of being a blind person in the Caribbean in terms of you having this opportunity to get a high school education and then a college education?
I think being Caucasian certainly helped. Having money certainly helped. And probably being a, quote, foreigner probably helped. I mean, I think all of those factors played a part because clearly in the Caribbean, at least at the time when I started my education, blind people were supposed to work in sheltered workshops, were expected not to be educated, and were supposed to count themselves lucky if they had actually been taught Braille and given an opportunity to go to school. And I found myself working a lot with blind folks, some while they were still in school, to try to help them to want to go further. And there's a young lady up in Toronto now who I'm in contact with some of the time, who's actually become an access technology trainer who I worked with when she was in school. And it was very satisfying stuff.
Was there a blindness movement, if you will, in the Caribbean? Did it parallel at all how things worked here in the United States?
Really, the answer is no and yes. No, there was no formalized blindness movement. I was actually offered a job and pondered seriously taking it to go around the Caribbean and try to encourage blind people and blind welfare organization to begin to be more proactive in terms of involving people who are blind. But I turned the job down believing that, in fact, I was too different from many of the blind folks who I would have to interact with to do a good job. And in fact, Aubrey Webson was the first person to do that job, who I think you know, Brian. And Aubrey, I think, was very much the right person for that job and really did a superb job of beginning to build a real blindness movement, which there certainly is now. Blind people made demands of governments and made demands of the organizations that they worked for, but they were often difficult for me as an American consumer to understand, so that they would on the one hand demand higher wages, which is perfectly fine, but on the other hand demand free phone service on the grounds that they were blind, which I had a little more trouble with.
While you were there, were these welfare organizations for the blind or of the blind as we now think of them?
Oh, very much for the blind. And there was very little government involvement anywhere. Governments put a little bit of money into schools for the blind in some of the islands. But as in Canada and as in many other, most other countries in the world, serving people who are blind was a charity, and it was a charity that was very much taken on by the private sector. And the folks who ran welfare organizations tended to be middle-class, well-meaning, and not very comfortable with blind people who dared to question the status quo.
So you came back to the United States. What age were you when you came back to the United States, and what was your involvement in consumerism once you arrived here?
Came back when I was 30, in 1976, and for the first year really had very little involvement, first year, year and a half. I looked at the National Federation of the Blind and didn't much like what I saw. I became involved in the Florida Council of the Blind, but my reasons for becoming involved were kind of complex, because when I got back here, I had expected to be streets and roads behind other people in this country. I thought that by virtue of the fact that people in this country had access to orientation and mobility training and had access to ongoing Braille training and technology training, I would be way back in the dark ages, while blind people would be immensely capable here. And that wasn't what I found, and I was really shocked. The United States was an eye-opener for me in that I found that a lot of blind people weren't living up to their potential. They simply were not doing a good job of accepting what they could. I went to the rehab center and spent hours trying to improve my orientation and mobility techniques, and many people were perfectly content to not be good travelers and to not worry very much about that. So one of my first reasons for getting involved in the consumer movement was to try to deal with understanding why it was that so many people turned their backs on access to services that could make them really competent, really independent. And then, of course, working for the Division of Blind Services, I began to see the other side of the coin. That is, blind people who simply weren't given opportunities, either because the system was malfunctioning or because there was real discrimination out there.
In terms of your ACB involvement, you started as a rank-and-file member of the Florida Council of the Blind. How long were you a member prior to being elected or appointed to your first position in leadership?
I wasn't so interested in becoming an officer in the Florida Council of the Blind, but was certainly interested in working. I met a lot of ACB people as they would come down to Florida. And fairly early on in my career, I became chair of the Resolutions Committee in Florida. And that's actually one of the things that got me involved in the national organization. Headed a lot of committees, put together a lot of chapters. My friend Doug Hall and I were kind of the two young radicals annoying all of the older members of FCB as relatively young folks working for the division. And Grant Mack came to our Florida convention, saw me do resolutions, and threw me to the lions in 1983, which was my first convention in Phoenix, I think.
Having chaired that committee myself before, I know it's a huge, huge time commitment. Did you get to see much of your first convention?
Actually, no, but it was fun. I loved chairing resolutions. I thought I was very comfortable there, because resolutions, I think, is where ACB makes a lot of its policy, to be able to have a part in helping that happen, as well as having a part in helping ACB members put their concerns into words that can perhaps get things changed, was a very satisfying exercise. In those days, resolutions weren't nearly so organized as they are now. We never started working on resolutions much before midnight, and we'd typically work on them until 4 in the morning and then go get a little bit of sleep, perhaps.
How many years were your resolutions chair? I know it was a number of them.
Gosh, I want to say 5 or 6 in a row, Brian, and then I skipped a few and then did one more in the mid-90s. But it was actually great fun and got to know loads of people. The first year was wonderful because I put my foot in my mouth about as often as anyone can. I remember people coming up to me afterwards and saying, "You recognized all the idiots and you didn't recognize any of the good people. Don't you know anything?" And they were probably perfectly correct. And I was a very brash kind of weird kid then anyway, because my view was that resolutions by definition are pretty boring. And if you're going to have to sit through listening to lots, you might occasionally get a laugh. I did all sorts of things that some of the more traditionalist ACB members still regard as heretical, like trying to make people laugh and using my sense of humor as part of the resolutions process.
And one time when you failed to recognize somebody to speak and it turned out to be a relative.
that was my wife. It's another kind of apocryphal thing. In fact, it went further than that because I declared her out of order, which very much made my relationship out of order. We had actually gone to Philadelphia with our kids on the train, and the ride back from Philadelphia to Daytona was one of the least pleasant train trips I've ever been on. I ended up spending most of it sitting up in the club car, very far away.
Did you hold state office or special interest affiliate office prior to holding national office in ACB?
Yes, I was first vice president and then president of the Braille Revival League, a special interest affiliate. I'm trying to remember if I was even... I was probably a board member in Florida, though. That's an awfully long time ago. I know I was never a president or a first vice president. One of the reasons was that I really felt that as long as I was working in blindness-related stuff in Florida, either for the Division of Blind Services or as an agency director, it would be wrong of me to assume an officer position in either of the consumer organizations. I think that there's a responsibility for folks in those kinds of positions to remain at least with the appearance of independence.
So when did you first run for ACB National Office, and can you tell us the story behind that?
Yeah, it's an indication of how young and stupid I was, Brian. I was approached by M.J. Schmidt, who we all know and love, who is, of course, now ACB's second vice president. And M.J. Approached myself and four other individuals to all run for the office of first vice president against Durward McDaniel. Durward, I guess, had made a commitment to the old-timers that while he wanted to remain active on the board, he would no longer seek a position as the first vice president, which would therefore put him immediately in the line of succession should something happen to the president, who at that time was going to be Otis Stephen. So I ran with these five other individuals, and by the third ballot of the election, ended up beating Durward and becoming first vice president in 1987 in Los Angeles.
So you were first vice president under Otis Stephens. Tell us the steps that you took through that whole process of being on the ACB board of directors.
Well, I was first vice president with Otis for a year, but then Otis decided, because his wife was as ill as she was, that he was going to resign as president of ACB, and Leroy Saunders took over. So essentially, I was in a place where I actually ran out of term time 2 years, or at least 1 year, before Leroy Saunders actually had to stop being president. And I worked pretty closely with Leroy. I think we made a good team. But I got off the board and didn't seek re-election to the board when my term as first vice president was up. And I actually believe that that's a responsible thing to do. We have term limits for a reason, and I think too many people on the ACB board regarded as a hereditary position and simply move from position to position, from officer to board member to officer, and sometimes perhaps stay on the board of ACB too long and don't give others an opportunity to emerge as potential leaders.
So after your 2 years off the board, that's when you ran for president?
Yeah, it's sort of bizarre, isn't it? held three offices in ACB, first vice president, president, and then immediate past president. And again, I wasn't sure I wanted to be president of ACB and certainly didn't see the election with huge open arms because I was working full-time, and I wasn't sure that I demonstrated as first vice president or in other positions that I'd held the kind of follow-through and the kind of commitment and the kind of real leadership potential that an ACB president ought to have had. What persuaded me to run eventually was a feeling that was bolstered by others that I had something to offer to ACB that the other candidate for the office at the time couldn't offer as well. And that candidate was Charlie Hodge, and we fought a relatively close race. Charlie is a very good politician, and in fact, I think, lives and breathes his life in terms of ACB politics. And I decided that all things considered, I wanted an opportunity to lead ACB forward.
It looks like the two of us may have, in fact, monopolized the microphone long enough. Is there anything else dealing with your ACB history that you'd like to put on the table?
Yeah, I think two things. The first thing is to say that once I became president, I think I learned an awful lot. I wouldn't have been nearly as good a president as I was had it not been for the fact that I had the best first vice president there's ever been in the history of ACB, and that's a guy named Brian Charlson. Brian kept me on my toes. I also had the opportunity of implementing ACB's new five-year plan, which was interesting. Leroy Saunders helped to create that plan, but it was left to me to implement it in all its glory. And one of the things that I ended up being able to do was to eventually hire an executive director who I thought moved us ahead immensely, and that was a guy named Charlie Crawford. So I was very fortunate in the people who worked with me when I was president of ACB. I think if I were to characterize what I think I brought to the ACB presidency, it was an ability to define and philosophically articulate in ways that I don't think had been done as well before what ACB represented and what its differences were with other organizations of blind folk. And the last thing I guess I would say about my ACB involvement is that being immediate past president has been an interesting exercise in that I've had the opportunity to spend 5 years now where I don't have to seek re-election and where I guess I perceive myself as kind of the conscience of ACB, because even though electors didn't elect me, I'm there because of posterity. I think it puts me in a kind of a unique position in that I don't have to worry about whether I'm going to get elected, so I can say some harsh things if they need to be said, and I can also speak out to the members of ACB from a position that's pretty clear, because I've made it absolutely clear that after this year, while I'll certainly continue to work with anyone who's elected as ACB president, or almost anyone, I have no intention in the future of running for any ACB office. I don't have political ambitions that will get in the way of my standing up and saying what I believe needs to be said.
Now we're going to open the mic to those who've joined us here this evening. Again, I want to remind you that the first time you ask your question, we'd ask that you identify yourself and where you're from and ask your question, give Paul a chance to answer it, and then follow that up with others asking questions.
This is Don Moore from Port Charlotte, Florida. I wanted to ask, you were discussing people's apathy with something you noticed when you came to the United States. With the unemployment figures of blind people being variously described between 70% and 74%, how much of that is apathy and how much do you think is discrimination?
I don't have any doubt, Don, and by the way, thanks very much for being here, that there is discrimination. I think there's lots of it out there, more than enough to go around, and I think there's specifically discrimination against folks who are blind. But I think that on the other hand, there is a propensity for blind people to accept less from themselves than they're actually able to give. I'm surprised by the relatively small number of blind people who are active in consumer organizations. 10% or less of blind people fit that rule. I'm surprised at the small number of blind people who volunteer in their community or get involved in anything except kind of hanging around at home and living day to day, hand to mouth on SSI or SSDI in rare instances. But the apathy, it seems to me, has to do with not being prepared to live up to their potential. And it may have a lot to do with the educational system not expecting enough of blind kids, parents not expecting enough of blind kids. But it also, when it all comes down to it, has a lot to do with blind people not expecting enough of themselves.
Hello, this is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I was wondering if maybe a lot of that apathy could be caused by the fact that maybe up until maybe 30 years or so, or maybe less, the idea of like services for the blind agencies is we think that you should do what we think is best for you instead of what you want to do. I mean, maybe that's what, for so many years, that's what these organizations maybe looked at things that way.
I'm sure there was some paternalism out there, Gary. I don't think that goes far towards explaining why it is that a blind person is fundamentally any different from any other individual in our society. Other individuals in our society have an obligation when they get married, when they have kids, to get a job, to make money. And for far too many folks who are blind, there is an expectation that somebody's going to take care of you. I don't think that, who says, among other things, that you should necessarily like your job? Did you love the job you did every day when you worked in Michigan? Did I love any of the jobs that I had every day, all the time? No, but your obligation, if you're going to work and if you're going to earn money, is to get involved in work for the sake of the rewards, partly of job satisfaction, but also partly of doing a good job of getting the job done and of earning some money.
Amen. Amen, Paul. This is Anisio. I've seen so many people actually leaving their jobs because they don't like the job, before they got another job. That's fine to, if you don't like your job, look for another one while you're working. That's what most people do. In your experience in the Caribbean, I know you've come across organizations that were both of and for the blind, and you see a lot in the development world organizations that do both. There are consumer organizations, societies for the blind, as they call them, or associations, and also provide services. What is your feeling about that, and is that a role for that kind of organization here in this country?
It's actually a fascinating issue. In a lot of ways, I think the model that operates in this country is actually the best one and creates the greatest capacity for blind people to be fully independent, because most of the services are delivered by governmental entities. We are, in fact, probably the only country that I know of, and maybe Brian has some other instances where that's the case. In all other countries, whether they're developed or not developed, services to blind people are delivered by organizations for the blind, which are becoming, as time goes on, more and more also organizations of the blind. I think the model has some severe limitations. On the one hand, service delivery systems in other countries deliver services using a charitable model. And when that charitable model is being used, it really limits the degree to which a person can be actively involved in the consumer movement. On the other hand, it also seriously impacts the degree to which consumer movements can speak out as openly as they can in this country, because if you cause the golden goose to stop laying, that is, if you cause charities to stop giving, then services to blind people go down the tubes. So I think the one disadvantage of the charitable model across the world is that it seriously limits the degree to which consumers can directly confront systems in order to change them directly.
Hi, Paul. This is Marlena in Seattle. You visited the Washington Council of the Blind just a week ago and gave just a tremendous, empowering banquet address. And we've received a fair amount of response from our members who were present since then, saying how much it meant to them to hear your message about how it is okay to be a person who is blind. And I wonder if I could ask you to kind of revisit that message again and share a little bit of that very empowering philosophy with our listeners.
I think far too often we grow up in a society where we're taught to be ashamed of our visual impairment. Our parents are ashamed of us, whether they want to admit it or not. Our parents are ashamed that we're blind and blame them to a degree. The school system begins by teaching us how inferior we are. Discrimination is out there, certainly, which continues to reaffirm the message. And the bottom line is that many of us, I think, have grown up with the belief that being blind is a bad thing, but it really isn't. And what we have to learn to do is to be proud of who we are, to recognize that every day that we survive, every day that we do things as simple as crossing the road, we're actually making huge strides in terms of reaffirming our personhood. The other thing that's really crucial here is most of us tend to set our standards of behavior based on what the rest of society believes. And almost by definition, this makes us inferiors because we see ourselves as others who are not blind see us. And one of the things that I've tried to persuade people to recognize is that at the heart of ACB is an ability of people who are blind to stand up and say to whoever cares, the standards that I need to set are standards that I set for myself, not simply as a person, but as a blind person. Those standards can be just as high as standards that somebody else will set for me, but they're my own, and they're set as a person who is comfortable with and happy with the idea of being blind. That was the thing that ACB gave to me as the empowering kind of lightning strike of a concept that hit me in the late 1970s, and I've been trying to give it to others ever since.
Paul, during the many years that you and I have worked together, I've always been just delighted at your eloquence and your ability to communicate both the vision and quite honestly to represent much of what is best about being a blind person. How would you describe the way you would like the rank and file of ACB, which is the strength of ACB, in my opinion? What level of commitment ought they to show to the blindness community as well as to themselves?
I think the first thing that the rank and file members of ACB ought to do is to recognize that they're actually leaders in ACB, whether they know it or not. ACB is a bottom-up organization. It is an inherently democratic organization. And if people have problems with the way ACB is at any point, they have themselves to blame, not other people. You have the opportunity to impact your affiliates. You have the opportunity to impact the national level. It isn't like the NFB, where elections are a foregone conclusion. That's absolutely not the case in ACB. I think that what I expect of rank and file members is to recognize that it is their organization, that they have the capacity to have a serious impact, and that they have the ability to turn ACB into whatever sort of organization they truly want it to become. If people believe we ought to have a mail ballot, if people believe that we ought to find a way to assure that, in fact, we vote secretly and privately in ACB as we've demanded that we vote in state and federal elections, those are things that I think that we ought to begin to bubble up from the bottom and demand that our affiliate leaders work towards, demand as well that our board members work towards. The bottom line is, I guess, what I expect of the rank and file members of ACB is to exercise the power that you have. And that power, frankly, is to change whatever it is that you choose to change in ACB. You have immense power. You only need to choose to use it.
Hi, Don again from Port Charlotte. Paul, the one thing I noticed with ACB over any other organization, I think, is the ability and willingness of the ACB leadership to be mentors to people coming up. When I started out in New York, people gave me so much encouragement to be so involved and whatever I thought was so important, and I was just gung-ho to do whatever for the organization. And, you know, I was allowed to think for myself, and a lot of times I didn't think the way a lot of the leaders thought, but it was okay. And that's one of the things I appreciate most about our organization that, frankly, I never would have got away with the other organization.
I think you've actually put your finger on a really important point, and it goes in two directions. I think the one thing is, sure, we encourage people to become active and to become leaders, and we encourage them to express opinions, even if they are pretty far from the mainstream, because we have confidence that what will eventually happen is whatever it is that the majority of the organization wants will develop into a policy that the rest of the organization will accept. Because at the same time as you have a responsibility to express your opinion, you also have a responsibility, it seems to me, to accept that a majority of your peers have made a decision and that the direction that's been chosen is an appropriate one. But I think the other thing that differentiates ACB from NFB in the context that you're talking about is that we are much more comfortable with people where they are. We don't expect everyone to be a Superman. We don't have a belief that absolutely everyone needs to be wonderful at mobility, that absolutely everyone needs to be a star Braille reader. What we expect people to do is to be all that they can be and to be proud of who they are, regardless of who that is. And I think that kind of open and caring acceptance of each other, that fraternal willingness to share and bond as blind people who recognize that diversity is not only valuable, it's essential, is probably the core thing that attracts me to ACB as opposed to other organizations.
And that's one reason that I joined the local chapter of the ACB, Local Council for the Blind. And I think you did a great job as president, Paul. I think that it is, like we were talking about, the way, you know, blind people, you know, the apathy of blind people. I think that it is disconcerting that they are so apathetic. Like, there are some things that I did, like I look forward to be a dictaphone typist, but there are times when I didn't always have work to do, and that was kind of depressing to me once in a while when I couldn't find anything to do. I had to wait till something could be dictated, and it bothered me sometimes to not be able to have anything to do till the next time I had some work, and then when I had other jobs as a tape cleaner, so to speak, clean tapes for the computers, I was more busy all the time, but every job you do has some good points and bad points, and sometimes the people you work with, you not always get along with them as well some days as you do other days. And I think that's probably the way life is, no matter what you kind of work you do or organization you belong to.
Paul, Steve Bauer. Regarding the image of a blind person, especially if you have proven yourself in a task or in a job, the perception that generally a sighted person has of you is usually predetermined based on their limited and most generally uninformed knowledge of what your abilities are and what you can accomplish. How do you deal with these people most effectively to get them basically to be on your side, to get them to realize that you can do even simple tasks just because you're blind and they don't know how you can do it doesn't mean that you can't do it?
It's a good question. And I think that my response is fourfold. First, the very first thing that you have to do is to not care as much. We spend an awful lot of time worrying about how sighted people perceive us. And if we were more confident in who we are and more comfortable with what we can accomplish and less concerned about proving ourselves to people to whom we will never be good enough, I think we could do better. Second, I think we need to recognize that, and this is one of the differences, I think, between ACB and NFB, that there is no such thing as integration of blind people into the society. I believe that the most we can push for is inclusion. We will always be perceived as inferior, and frankly, if we let it worry us, it seems to me that we're just wasting an awful lot of our time. That's why our value system needs to be focused on who we are as blind people and a comfort level with that philosophy. I think the third component of answering your question is to say we tend to set arbitrary limits for ourselves about how far outside of the traces we're prepared to go. And I think those arbitrary limits often need to be transcended. Occasionally we do need to, if you like, show off. We do need to do considerably more once or twice just to basically make a statement, but not because we want to show these other people, but rather because we don't choose to be constrained by their expectations. And I think the fourth answer to your question is much of our notion of their expectations is colored by societal standards and values that we've grown up with. To argue that we aren't prejudiced and to argue that we don't have some of the same unbelief in ourselves, some of the same notions of who blind people are that the rest of society is simply unrealistic. The fact is that one of the very first things we need to do is to truly examine the degree to which we've been able to get beyond our prejudices and truly assume an identity that would then transcend how sighted people perceived us.
People are prejudiced. The ADA is supposed to eliminate all that, a lot of that. But what are we going to do to eliminate some of that through other means? Because obviously they're getting around the ADA somehow.
People use the ADA, Karen, and thanks for your question, as a supposed answer to everything. Well, the fact is it isn't. Those of us who've been around for a long time saw the same kind of initial euphoria when 504 was passed. The fact is that the ADA doesn't have a lot of specific methods of preventing prejudice. What the ADA is intended to do is to level the playing field. It's intended to say, if you are as qualified and as capable as the next person, you want to have an equal opportunity of getting a job. If you have money that's as good as the next person's, you ought to have the same opportunity to shop. If you live in a community that's governed by a local or state government, you ought to have the opportunity to partake in the services and programs that are offered by that entity to the same degree as people who don't have disabilities can. But that's all the ADA is supposed to do. I think the ADA will have some long-term impacts on prejudice by forcing more people who are not disabled to interact with people who are, and by forcing people who aren't disabled to become more actively involved in training programs so that they come to understand the nature of disability a little bit more. I don't think that the immediate impact of the ADA is going to be nearly as important as the long-term impact. And the other major component of the ADA, from my perspective, is that it puts the shoe on the other foot. Before, we perceived ourselves as needing to beg when we wanted help from someone else. Now, the ADA says that we have a right to expect assistance and to expect to be full participants in our society. And those aren't insignificant things. What we have to do is persuade ourselves to be pushier, and then when we don't get what we want, to persuade ourselves to file more complaints. The ADA hasn't done much for blind people, and one of the reasons that it's true that it hasn't is that the smallest number of complaints per capita come from people who are blind.
Paul, you've been in leadership for many, many years in ACB, and not just in ACB, but also in the National Accreditation Council and other activities. If you were to describe, say, the three most important improvements or accomplishments that we as blind people have accomplished during that time, what would they be?
Gosh, well, the first one would be technology and a capacity to grasp it. And as you know, Brian, it's a two-edged sword, because while technology has liberated blind people immensely, it has also crippled us by changing so quickly that we're simply not able to keep up with it. But I think technology is the first. I think the second is a better notion of who we are. I really think that it's easy for us to denigrate just how much the blindness movement, including the NFP, has done to change the way that blind people perceive ourselves. But I truly believe that one of the most valuable things is that we truly do have an identity that is substantially different from what it was 30, 40 years ago. And the third thing would be related to technology, but going a little bit beyond it, and that is access to information. I think the chief problem that blind people had as a group 30 years ago was that there simply was a limited amount of information that was available to them, and other people determined what that information, the information that they were going to get, was going to be. That flat out isn't true anymore. A blind person has access to more information than we can ever use, and has the opportunity and the tools to access whatever information he or she truly wants. That can be anything from information on how you can become a cool pedophile to how you can become a saint in the Catholic Church.
We all, as blind people, need to work on our own attitudes about blindness. How do you think we best can accomplish that, and especially as not only as a blind person, but as a manager in a rehabilitation facility? What is the role of services, blind services providers, in that process, and how can we utilize or take advantage of the consumer movement to accomplish that?
Agencies for the blind have to be far more proactive in encouraging consumers to become directly involved in developing and implementing programs. And I absolutely believe that the time when agencies can operate with set curricula and specific short-term opportunities for people to be in institutions is over. We have to recognize that our job is to rehabilitate each individual who comes into our system, and that each individual needs to be evaluated independently and specifically in terms of determining that individual's need. And the thing that we perhaps need to do more than anything else in agencies for the blind is to not lower expectations. I believe that the chief failure of currently existing private agencies for the blind is that we have set floors for ourselves with our accreditation process that have tended to become ceilings. What we need to do is to recognize that our job is to enable every blind person who comes into that door to become as much as that person can be. And if that requires pushing, if that requires kicking, if that requires a longer period of time there, I think we have an obligation to assure that whatever methods we need to use, we create blind people who are just as good as they can possibly be. Right now, we create blind people who are as good as the agency believes they ought to be.
I want to thank Paul for agreeing to be on the hot seat this evening, and thank all of you for your probing questions. I think you can see why we've not just accidentally come up with Paul Edwards as the host of Tuesday Topics. He truly is a gentleman whose breadth as well as depth of knowledge on subjects associated with blindness, the passion that he brings to issues associated with blindness, are so very, very important for somebody in this particular role. Again, I'd like to thank everybody for being here this evening and ask that you all join us again here next week for our next edition of Tuesday Topics here on ACB Radio.
Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll explore Braille transcription. How did it start? What has it contributed? And where are we now? What impact have computers and technology had on Braille transcription. To what degree has Braille transcription kept up? How well are we managing to get the stuff that we need in specialized codes like Nemeth or chemistry or music? These topics and more will be a part of next week's Tuesday topic, Braille Transcription, on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.